This is an interview with Clara Davis for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Stacy Jagels at 733rd Street, Apartment D, Bakersfield, California, on Thursday, January 29th, 1981 at 9:30 a.m. Okay, why don't we start off with your childhood? You can tell me where and when you were born and what it was like growing up in a family of, what, 16 children?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was born in Pauls Valley, Oklahoma, on May the 13th, 1918. I lived on a farm till I was 6 years old. My earliest memories of the farm was when I was about 2 years old. A year before that, my father had got crippled, and he was in Oklahoma City in the hospital for a year. I remember when they brought him home from the hospital. They brought him from Pauls Valley out to our farm in the back of a wagon. And he was crippled. He had blood poisoning in his leg, and he never walked again without two crutches. And he stayed on the farm then until I was 6 years old, and he gave that up for a county office. He was elected to county office in 1924. We had a good life on the farm, but my next memory that sticks in my mind was the day we moved into town. It was 16 miles into town. It was Thanksgiving Day, 1924. And my mother cooked Thanksgiving dinner the day before. They had two wagons to take our furniture into town, and they had a car to take my mother and my father and the smaller children in. She had the Thanksgiving dinner in the car, and we stopped on the side of the road and waited on them to catch up, and we had our Thanksgiving dinner on the side of the road on our way into town. And my father went into office then the 1st of January in 1925. We lived in several different houses. And we were a very happy bunch of kids, even though there was a big bunch of us. We each had our own work to do. We did our work. We weren't yelled at. We weren't told, you've got to do this. We knew exactly what we had to do. We got our spending money on Sunday morning. Sometimes it was a nickel, and sometimes it was a dime. But it lasted us with candy all week long. We were raised in church. We started to church when we moved to town. And we stayed in church all of our life. And we had one sister and two brothers born after we moved into town. Of course, my mother never worked, only at home. But
well, was it kind of a tight squeeze trying to feed and clothe and
it was
16 children?
It was, I can imagine now, very hard for my father. Like I say, he was in county office. And but we had an aunt and uncle that lived on the farm. And nearly every morning my uncle came to town in his truck. And he brought milk and butter and eggs, farm products every day to us. So that helped a lot, an awful lot. And then in the wintertime, they killed hogs. Of course, we got that meat brought in too. So I can still imagine it was very hard on my father, though, to raise 16 kids because his salary was very small in the office he held. And but when we got, as each one of us got big enough, we worked. My brothers worked on the farms, and my sisters and I worked housework for the people in town. That money went to help support the family. But we had spending money out of it too. We usually bought some of our clothes with that. And then we had money for the show and things for weekend, which was very hard to do with a large family like that too. But we lived real good. We were very happy. And then as they, some of them were married away before the younger ones were born. But when we moved into town in 24, there was 12 of us. We were all at home because there was 4 born after we moved to town then. But there were, and so that took a very large house. And my father at the time, he didn't buy a home. He wanted to look around and find one, you know, that was big enough. Well, by the time he got around to looking around and everything, well, the Depression hit then, and he didn't buy a house. He never bought a house. We rented, but we always had a large house to live in. We had about 4 or 5 bedrooms, and it took that many. And my grandmother lived with us, too. I guess she moved into town with us. I don't recall that because I was young, but I can't ever recall not having my grandmother in the house with us until she passed away. And my mother would go, when somebody in the family got sick, my mother would go to take care of them, and my grandmother took care of us. So we really had 2 mothers. And not, she wasn't like a grandmother, she was just like a mother to us.
Could you tell me a little bit about school?
Well, we went to school. My two oldest brothers, they quit school in the 10th or the 11th grade. And my oldest sister got married when she was 15. And we all, the older ones of us, quit school to work and help make a living. We went through, all of us went through the 8th grade, some of them a year or two in high school. But I didn't. I finished the 8th grade. And I quit to go to work full time. And there's several younger than me that quit after eighth or ninth grade. And then the 4 that was born after we moved to town, the first one passed away at 18 months, but the 3 younger ones, they all finished high school. And they were the only 3 in the family that did finish high school. So we were all really proud of them because we didn't get to. It was just a thing that we couldn't do. And the sister that finished high school, she moved to Texas. She married and moved to Texas. And she had 4 boys. And when her youngest one was small, her and her husband separated and divorced. She went to college at night and worked. And she graduated from college the 18th of May, 1980. And she was 50 years old the 8th of June, 1980. And she's a school teacher now. So we're really proud of her. And
you said when you were after the 8th grade, you quit school to go to work. What kind of job did you have, and what kind of jobs did the rest of your brothers and sisters have?
My sisters and I, we done housework for people. And my brothers worked. At that time, there was a lot of hay baling going on in our community. The older ones worked in the hay. And then some of the younger ones worked at a service station. And I guess that's, you know. But my oldest brother then went on, and he was deputy sheriff of Garvin County, where we lived. And from there, he went to Norman, Oklahoma. He was chief of police in Norman, Oklahoma. And then he went in service in World War II. And he came out of the service, and he went into, can you stop that? Ready? He went into work in the interstate commerce in the cigarette and tobacco tax division, and worked in the state capitol in Oklahoma City until 5 years ago when he retired. And he is living in Norman, Oklahoma now. But
it was kind of tough trying to take care of 16 plus the two parents and your grandmother and everything. But do you remember it when you were a child in Oklahoma, if you were any better off than some people or worse off? Or remember how you fit in the community that way?
Well, we were middle class, I guess. We always lived in a good neighborhood. But our neighbors next door had one child. Naturally, they could do more for that one child than my father could do for 16. But we fit in with those people. We had a good life there, and we were better off than some people, yes. But naturally, there was people that had more than what we did. But we had a good life. We had neighbors down the street from us that had a store there. They had two girls. And I can remember when I was a child, those girls would come by from work in the evening, especially in the summertime, and they'd stop and they'd watch us on the lawn because we weren't allowed out of the yard without asking. We had a huge lawn and we played there all the time. We had trees to climb. We had everything that a child needed. We didn't have everything we wanted, but what we needed. And they would just, I guess those two girls really envied us because they said we had a lot of brothers and sisters, and they didn't have a brother, just the two sisters. I couldn't see it at the time, you know, because I thought, well, they must be crazy. But now I can see it because we are a very close-knit family. I think bigger families are closer than smaller families. And we had, in the summer, a couple of times in the early part of the summer, my father would take us to a resort, Turner Falls, Oklahoma, and we camped out for a week at Turner Falls. And then the first week in August, we had a family reunion at Turner Falls, a week's family reunion. And we had around 500 relatives from Texas and Oklahoma come for that family reunion. And in fact, I've just found out now that this family reunion still goes on down in East Texas. And if I get to go to Oklahoma this summer, that I'm going in August when they have this reunion, and my sister and I are going down there to the reunion. It's down in Sabinetown, Texas. That's where this all started, this book. So we hope to get down there for that this summer.
Could you tell me what it was like when the Depression came?
Well, I can, when the Depression first hit, maybe I didn't pay much attention to it then, but as time went on, I mean, within 6 months after it hit, you know, well, I can see now that we were, my father lost everything we had, and he was still in office, though. He held that office until 1941, and
what was his title, his job?
He was the county weigher. They weighed the trucks and anything that came over the scales to weigh. And one little incident I can remember when the Depression first hit. My sister was born, and my mother made us two dresses apiece when school started, and we had those two dresses to wear to school. And but I had worked for a neighbor there, I'd worked quite a bit for, and her daughter had, this is rather silly, but her daughter had a yellow silk dress, and it, to me, it was the most beautiful thing there was. And she gave it to me. Well, I only wore that dress to Sunday school and church. It stayed in the closet, told me. And I didn't know my mother was expecting another baby. But I went to get my dress one day, and it was gone one Sunday to go to Sunday school. Of course, I accused my sisters of taking it off and letting somebody else wear it. No, nobody knew anything about it, so it went on, and I couldn't find that dress. And after my sister was born, well, my mother had took that dress and made her a dress out of it. And without saying anything to me, well, even though she was about the 14th child, we were just as proud of her as anybody ever was, so that was all right for her to have that dress. And so anyway, we still laugh about that incident, about Mama taking my dress and making Marie one out of it. And but then she had two more. She had the two boys after that. And I was so proud when that last kid was born in that family. Even though we really loved them all, we all just really was a close family. This is my mother and father.
Well, you said your father lost everything in the Depression. Can you remember what things?
No, I can't. I can't because I didn't, I mean, a 12-year-old child don't pay much attention to things like that. I just can remember hearing them talk. And I can't really remember what he lost. But they said he lost everything. And I remember another incident that happened the year Franklin Roosevelt was elected. I was sitting on the front porch, and an elderly man came down the street as a friend of my father's. And he stopped and talked for a minute, and he started to cross the street, and a car drove up. And a man jumped out and picked up a rock and hit him in the head. And I hollered at my mother, and she ran out the door and hollered at him, and then she called my father, and my brothers came home, and they called his sons. And they had hit him. This man had hit this elderly man because he knew he had voted for Franklin Roosevelt. And it was, I mean, he just, oh, he really laid one on him on his head. But I couldn't imagine then anyone of doing something like that, but now it doesn't seem so bad. So, and then, well, to get to the dust storm now. That dust came in, you know, from Kansas through northern Oklahoma, and the sky was just as red as it could be. And then the dust started coming in down, you know, because it... my mother was in the hospital. I don't remember what for. I don't know if she'd had a baby or what. But... I think we already had the baby at home, and I don't remember what she was in the hospital for. But it got so bad that you couldn't even see the houses across the street, and it would just come in through the windows and everywhere. And somewhere we got the idea to wet sheets and hang them over the window. And with a dozen kids to make beds for and everything, we didn't have too many sheets. And I know my mother came in, we had those sheets hanging over the window. But it kept out the dust. I mean, you know, if you wet them and hang them over the window, well, it kept the dust out. But that dust was terrible. And I know we didn't go out. I don't think my father even went to work for several days because he couldn't get out, you know. At that time, we didn't have a car. I don't know if he ever owned a car when we were younger or not. I don't know whose car it was that moved us into town from the farm. But we didn't have a car because he was crippled and couldn't drive a car. So apparently he must have got rid of the car when he moved into town. But by the time my brothers got up old enough, well, they would manage to get some old kind of a car. And so when we were teenagers, we always had a car because my brothers had one. And we, our brothers let us go with them. They took us, you know, and most kids nowadays, you know, their brothers won't let their sisters go, but they took us. And one time when one of my brothers is older than me, my oldest brother had a car, and we was going to go to Turner Falls for the day, and he was going to take us. Well, something came up, he had to go to work, and he couldn't go, so my younger brother didn't know how to drive a car. And he took him out the car and he showed him how to shift that thing. And he said, "Now you take him to Turner Falls." It was 28 miles to Turner Falls. And we got in that car with him and went to Turner Falls, and he'd never been behind the steering wheel before in his life. And he took us down there and back. Mm-hmm. We spent the day. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, when you were talking about the dust storms, do you remember how long this went on, or did it come in gusts, like a lot of dust for a few days and then it would go away?
No, I think this just stayed for, I couldn't really tell you but how long it stayed, but I know it just, you know, it just blowed everything away. I mean, on the farms, and that's when the people started coming to California to get out of there, because the people on the farms had nothing left whatsoever. They was just, it would just dip it out here and pile it up over there somewhere, you know, because there was nothing. And that's what brought on the rotting of the grapes of wrath, is when those people started leaving those farms because there was nothing there to farm, no land to farm, and nothing to farm with. So they started leaving and coming to California. Well, by then I was big enough and old enough to, I would sit and just wish that my dad would go to California, although he had nothing to do with the farm except his job. The farms kept his job going. But I would just sit and wish that he would go to California. And so, well, that was out of the question. And then at one time it got so bad there that my dad just wasn't making any money at all, hardly. And so they decided they would move us out on my cousin's farm. And we could get some work to do out there, us kids could. Well, I was old enough by then, must have been about 16. And I just told my oldest brother, he was deputy sheriff then, and I said, you can move them out there, but I'm not going, because I hated the country. I said, I'll get a job somewhere here in town, and I'll stay in town. Well, he said, okay, they won't, there's no need in moving out there then. And then they wanted my father to run for the state legislature. And he was assured that he had no problems, I mean, no worries, that he would be elected. But we would have to move to Oklahoma City. I said, I will not go to Oklahoma City. I was a small town girl. I wasn't going to Oklahoma City. I said, I will stay here. And my sister is younger than me. She says, I'll stay here too. And my brother over me that was still at home, he said, well, I'll stay here too. So my father said, well, I'm not going to tear him up. I'll stay here. And we weren't old enough to realize that my father could have went on and done a lot better for us, especially for the younger ones. But we didn't. We didn't take that into consideration. We were thinking about, well, we'd be better off to stay and let them move on up there. But he didn't go. But anyway, I always had this idea of going to California. Mm-hmm. And when my husband, before we married, he asked me to marry him, I said, will you go to California? Sure.
Did your aunt and uncle lose their farm too?
No, I don't guess they did, because they stayed on the farm, but he eventually gave it up and moved into town as they got older. When he retired, they moved into town. They gave up the farm. So I was already in California before he retired. So I don't know what he done. He sold it, I guess.
Do you remember the farmers talking about the drought and what that had done to their crops?
Oh, yes. It just wiped them all out. And I know the... picked cotton. We didn't start to school when school started in August. School starts in August back there. We didn't start to school then because we had to go out and pick cotton then. Somebody would come and get us and take us out every day. And then at times there was places where my mother and the ones that was big enough to pick cotton would move out on a farm and pick till, I guess, in October, around the 1st of October. Well, see, we didn't get to start school until the 1st of October. But we had a very intelligent father. And in a week after we started school, we was caught up with the rest of the class. Because I have sat many a night, till after midnight, right at the table, him sitting with us, going over our back lessons that we didn't get when we started school. And we all made almost straight A's in school. And it was our father that done it. But we've talked about it since then, my sister and I, that it was foolish. We think, I don't know, but we think it was foolish for our father to keep us out of school like that. But apparently he needed the money very bad, or he wouldn't have kept us out. So we didn't really lose too much schooling after that.
Okay, we were talking about the Dust Bowl and the drought, and I wondered if you'd also heard anything about tractors coming to the farms and doing most of the work. Some people think that a lot of tractors were on the farms, and so people lost their jobs. Do you remember hearing anything about that?
Well, if that happened, it probably happened after I left Oklahoma. But now, I saw, I don't know if it was in this documentary, when they made this, the crew from London made this, but or if it was it in the Grapes of Wrath, where they showed the tractors going in there and just leveling everything? Did you see the Grapes of Wrath?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have tractors in that?
I think so.
It's been so long since I've seen it, but I know, remember seeing something where they would take those bulldozers and go in there and just level those houses off and I guess trying to level the land up. But of course now they have lots of tractors back. That's all they have is the tractors. But now when my brothers worked on the farm, baling hay, they had a team of horses to pull that baler, and they walked along the side of it with pitchforks, throwing the hay in the baler to bale it. That's the way it was baled when I was a kid back there. And I can't recall ever seeing a tractor back there when I was a kid. I can, after I married and come out here and went back, of course they were all over the place, but...
Do you ever remember people referring to the railroads as one of the reasons why they were losing money? Some people say that the railroad rates were so high that they couldn't afford to have their goods shipped, and that was one of the reasons they lost money.
Yeah, I've heard that. Mm-hmm. But now, a lot of the stuff then was hauled in trucks, because that, like cattle and hay and stuff like that, because that was my father's job to weigh all of that. It had to be weighed over the county scales before it could be sent anywhere. And of course they hauled all the cattle to Oklahoma City to the market. And they were all in Garvin County. They were all weighed over my father's scales where he was employed. And at times when they was baling hay in the summertime back in the 30s, he taught us kids how to weigh on those huge scales. And he would stay till way in the night, and then one of my brothers would go stay open the rest of the night. And then some of us early of morning, because he kept them open 24 hours a day in the summertime, back in the early 30s when hay was so plentiful, you know, when, I don't suppose they raise as much there now as they did, I don't know. But
you said that when the Depression came, he didn't make nearly as much money. Was he paid a salary by the county, or did it depend on how much
he was paid by the weight?
And so when the farmers stopped or couldn't farm their land, then that directly affected him?
Yes, uh-huh. And now, see, they don't even have the scales there anymore. They done away with them because they didn't need them now. Yeah, when things picked up, he made more money. When they went down, he made less money. And then it started in the 30s that he, I think he was there about 10 years. He made good money for about 10 years. And then he would have stayed on the farm, but he was, like I said, he was crippled. He couldn't walk without two crutches. And he realized the boys were getting old enough till they would be married away from home pretty soon. He couldn't depend on them. And I had three brothers older than me, as all the boys there were older than me. And the others were younger, small. And so he knew that those boys would be up and gone before the others even got halfway big enough to do any farming. So that's why he gave up the farm and went into the office then, where he would have a better job. That he didn't have to get, you know, he sat all the time, so he didn't have to get out and walk around. And he fell several times just walking on his crutches and broke his leg then. You know, one crutch would go in a hole, and one time I remember he was on a Sunday and he was in the office and my mother was real bad sick. And she got real bad and they called him. Instead of somebody going after him, they called him. Somebody called him at the office and told him. And he couldn't find anybody to bring him home, so he started walking. And it was, there was no sidewalk or paved street where he was walking. And he said he thought he heard a car coming, and he looked around behind him to see, and his crutch went in a hole, and he fell and broke his leg. And they could never set it because it was, see how he's got it in front of him there? It was drawed that way, and they could never set a leg, his leg. And I don't know how long he laid there before finally my brother went to see about him and found him laying on there where he fell and broke his leg. But then we came to California. Well, we got married in July in 37.
Could you tell me a little bit about your husband and how you met him?
Yes, I met him at church. two of my sisters and I had went to church one Sunday night. My mother didn't go that night, or this would have never happened. And a friend of ours that we grew up with, he came into church and this guy was with him. And they sit down across from us, you know, and I asked my sister, I said, Opal, who is that guy with Whitey? And she said, well, I think it's Vernon Davis's brother. And I said, well, if he'll stay till church is over, I'll find out. And they didn't stay. They got up and left. And I told her, I said, come on, let's go. If my mother had been there, we wouldn't have left. But we had to go a couple of blocks and cross a creek, cross a bridge. And when we got to the bridge, they were sitting there waiting on us. And this friend, Whitey, he said, well, I knew when I left you would follow me. And he was just, you know, a close friend, just like a brother to us. So we went on, went to the show, and I was about 16 then, and so we got home, and my sister told me, she said, now don't tell Mama who you was with. I said, why? I mean, I was one, I talk all the time. And she said, because he's Vernon Davis's brother, and you know Mama don't like Vernon Davis. That was a guy that lived out in the country, one of my other sisters went with. So we got up next morning, and Mama asked us where we'd went. She knew we'd come in late, you know. And Opal said, we went to the show, and she said, who with? And we said, Whitey Coffee. And she said, who else? And I said, Arthur Davis. And she said, you go with him again, and I'll beat you to death. So I sneaked around and went with him. And I was 16 years old, and we got married when I was 19 then. I went with him off and on for 4 years. But eventually my mother met him, and, you know, and so I finally told her, I said, he is not Vernon Davis's brother, he's his nephew. And so she met him, she liked him, and in fact, he lived in the country, and it got to her that if I went out anywhere when he didn't come to town, she'd tell him. But anyway, we got married. In July, the 17th, 1937, and we was living in Lindsay, Oklahoma, and he was working in broom corn, cutting broom corn. That was another thing that they raised there. And he was getting 20 cents an hour for cutting broom corn. Well, he worked at that for about a month, and it was over with, and we came back to Paul's Valley. And we was living with his parents. And on a Sunday afternoon, on the 20th of August in 1937, two of his cousins came by from, they lived down in eastern Oklahoma, and they said that they were going to California. And so he asked me, they asked him if he wanted to go, so he asked me, and I said, sure, I want to go. But when I was a kid, I'd never go away from home and stay over one night because I'd scream and bawl till they'd take me back home. And so he said, well, let's get our things packed. We're going. I said, but we don't have the money to go to California. And one of the cousins said, oh, that's all right. We got enough money. Just have enough to eat for your eats. And so, okay, well, we had a little bit of money, you know. And we packed our clothes. And we got in the car, and the next morning we went up and told my parents we were going to California. And, of course, they were stunned because I had one sister to come to California before that, but she was already back home. And we left there on Monday morning on the 21st of August. And we got to Arvin, the Arvin labor camp there, on Saturday, and that's how long it took us to come out here. And when we got there, we, well, out on the Mojave Desert, out of Needles, we come up on a family sitting side of the road, and they flagged us down and said that their car was broke down. They were from Duncan, Oklahoma, and they needed some help. So my husband and his cousin stopped, and they got the car to run it. And it was an elderly man and his wife and three kids, two girls and a boy. The boy was grown. And he said he had drove all the way from Duncan, Oklahoma by himself because his father couldn't drive. And that if one of the men with us would finish helping him drive, that they had kids in the Irving labor camp. They had some daughters there. And we could go with them and stay there until we could get a place to live. So we came with them on into Arvin, and those people we'd never seen before in our life took us in. And we stayed with them for about a week till we found a place to live in. And those people are still good friends of ours. But
and when you came out, could you tell me, well, it took almost a week then from Monday to Saturday. What did you do along the way for food? And when you wanted to sleep, did you just pull alongside the road or did you find someplace?
Well, we would stop and buy food in the grocery store. And several mornings we would eat breakfast in a cafe, but that was the only time we'd eat in the cafe. At night we'd drive until they got tired and we'd just stop and sleep. And they and we broke down ourselves over in New Mexico, and it was around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And so we saw a depot where down railroad track was off the highway. And we pulled down by this depot, got the car down there, broke a spring on the car, that's what it was. And we pulled down by there and slept till daylight. Well, there was it was just a very small place, but there was a blacksmith shop there. And when this guy opened the blacksmith shop, they asked him if he could make a spring for the car. And he said that he could find something to make a spring out of. And he got an old wagon wheel, the outer rim of a wagon wheel. and said he could make one out of that to get us on out here. Well, there was a hotel in this depot there, and we went up there and had breakfast, and when we went back, we waited around, and he got that wagon wheel spring made for us and put it on the car. That's the only car trouble we had, and I think it cost us 75 cents to get that made. And we didn't have any more trouble then. But we run on those people that had the trouble, and they brought us on into California. We had rain on us in Arizona then. Typical Okie style in the 30s, we had our suitcases tied on the fenders, on the top and in the back, wherever. And the ones, we had one tied on each fender, so when it started raining so hard, we just got out and put the suitcases in the car with us and parked and set the side of the road or, you know, wherever we could find a place to park. But we made it in on a Saturday here then. And then this was, like I say, the last of August in 1937 when we got here.
Do you remember coming over the Tehachapi Mountain?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
What was that like?
It was the most scariest thing I ever went over in my life. And when we come down that mountain, into Arvin. We didn't come into Bakersfield. We come down what they call the White Wolf Grade then. We come down that, and I'll tell you, when we come out that first time and saw that valley down below, that was the most beautiful sight I ever seen, because the farmland was just laid out, you know, perfect. When I saw that, I told my husband, I said, now that is the prettiest thing I ever seen. And it was just beautiful. So we came on into Arvin then. When we got into the Arvin camp, labor camp there, well, of course, everybody was from Oklahoma, Texas, or Arkansas one. And in fact, there were several families from my hometown there. In fact, today I can start out somewhere, walk in a store somewhere, and somebody knows me from there, but I don't know them. And last Saturday night in Wasco, I went up to see Ernest Tubb at the high school auditorium, and I started out, and this guy was standing there, and he says, "Hello, Clara." And I said, "Well, hello, you know me, but I don't know you." Of course, you know, people don't forget me. And like the people from Paul's Valley say, they never forget my family because there was so many of us, and we just were all born and raised there. And all of my family, well, my father came from Texas to Oklahoma, but he married and raised, you know, all of his family there and was in office and everything. But I see so many people. Now, this John Blake, I don't know if I'd know him if I was to see him. But apparently he knows me because he has talked to this guy and several others. Well, sure, I know her. I know her family. Mm-hmm.
You said that when you were a little girl, or rather a teenager, you would sit and just wish that your father would come out to California. Do you know why you wanted to come to California? What things you had heard about California made you want to come here so much?
I had heard about how you could make more money out here, and I knew we needed a place where we could to get in a place where we could make more money, because it was so hard to make a living at that time in the 30s after the Depression. And I just thought, well, if we could get to California, that I wouldn't mind going out in the fields and working, because they said the work was so much better. Even the cotton picking, as bad as I hated that, I could do that. And they sent flyers out from they printed the flyers and sent them out from California to Oklahoma and distributed them around for people to come out here, which was a big nothing. I mean, I don't know why the people in California done that, but they sent them what big money you could make, you know, and what wonderful living places you had and everything. Well, and how you could make money working in the grapes and picking cotton and all this and that, you know. And the only thing that I was disappointed in when I came out here, when I got in that Arvin labor camp and all those tents were stretched up over those wooden platforms, that's something you never seen in Oklahoma, is people living in tents, because they couldn't do it. The winters are so bad back there. And but then I decided, well, maybe that'd be a pretty good way to live, you know.
Do you remember actually seeing one of these flyers?
No, I don't actually remember seeing it, but in my mind I can remember reading it, but I can't remember seeing it.
Do you know who had sent these? Do you know what ranchers?
No, I don't know what ranchers sent them. They're just, and I don't really know if it was ranchers or if it was just people doing it on their own. But somebody back there for a long time had one of them, kept one of those. And I, when I think about it, I think, well, when I go back there, I'm going to get that and make a copy of it and bring it back, because I'm a nut when it comes to collecting things like that. And but I forgot who it was. And so I've never been able to get one. I'd sure like to get one, though, because I would like to keep it along with all this stuff. I had all this stuff in put away in an album, and somebody wanted to use it, and then they took some more of my stuff. I had a lot more, and they haven't brought it back. But my son has got the same thing that I wanted to keep. And
you said you were a little bit disappointed when you saw that everybody lived in tents.
Yeah.
And you kind of changed your mind about that. Were there any other things that you had heard about California, and then you came out here and found out they weren't true, or perhaps some things that you found were true?
Well, the main thing I found out that wasn't true, there wasn't too much work to do around, because the first winter we was here was just picking cotton. Well, that was over with, and then there was nothing else. They couldn't find a job. And that winter we got help from the welfare. And then in the spring, we had moved to another ranch, where we moved out on this ranch to pick cotton. It was Lester Frick's ranch, south of Arvin. That's where we got our first job. And we moved down there. Well, we went down there to see that. Well, they had some little two-room cabins down there, you know. Well, that was better than the tents, but I still had my mind on that tent, you know. I mean, I guess just for the fun of it, I wanted to live in one of them. And so we stayed there that fall and winter, part of the winter, on Lester Frick's place. And then we moved to another place, I forgot the name of it. And got help from the welfare. And then he got a job, my husband got a job driving a tractor for Mr. Cobb. He was a farmer down there, a rancher down there. And
could you describe to me the cabin that you lived in on the Frick Ranch?
It was two rooms, and the kitchen was, I imagine, about 6 by 12. And the bedroom was, we had one bed and then a half-size bed in it. And that's practically about all we had to start out, you know.
What about getting water and
there was water.
Sanitation.
Well, they had the outsides there, but they had the water, the pump where they irrigated, and they had hydrants all around. There was several cabins there, and they had put hydrants around by every door, every side of every house, you know. And we got a water from that and carried it in. And we would have to, let's see, I don't think there he even had a place. I'm sure he did, because I think the health department required it that he have a place for us to take a shower to. I think he had outside showers in with the bathrooms, you know. And everybody had to use the same ones. And but then he got this, first he got a job, though, with Jack Stoltz. I don't know if you've ever heard of him or not. And he was irrigating way south on the desert at night. And I would go with him because we didn't. Then we had managed to get us a car. And he got this job irrigating with Jack Stoltz. We had bought we went and bought a 1928 Graham Page. That was the biggest old car I ever seen. And we bought it from C.C. Douglas, car lot here in Bakersfield. We give $80 for it. We paid $5 down, and we paid it out $5 a month. And he would irrigate at night down there, and I'd go with him and sleep in the car. And it was far out on that desert south of Arvin there that he'd have to build up a fire to keep the coyotes away. And so then he went to work for Mr. Cobb, which was Jack Stoltz's father-in-law, a driving a tractor. And that's when I moved in a tent. But I had the dirt floor, because we couldn't, he didn't have any houses. And we lived that way for about a month in that tent. And that satisfied me with living in a tent. So then we moved into a house then. And then in the spring of 38, he went to, kept going to DiGiorgio Farms down there. They were opening up, and they'd have to go every morning, and they would hand out numbers to go in and work so many people. And my husband was tall like I am, and he'd come home, and so one morning he got up, he said, I'm going to get one of those numbers today. And this morning he got out there early, and he got right up to where that guy was on the platform, and he just reached up and took one out of his hand and walked in and got a job and went to work picking fruit.
Oh, the DiGiorgio. So there were so many people that wanted jobs.
So many people.
A number, mm-hmm. Like waiting in line or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah. And he got a job there. And some friends of ours, he wasn't as tall as my husband, but he hung on to him and got him a number two. And he went in with him. They went to work. And like I say, I had this old Grand Page. We had this old Grand Page, the biggest old thing. And so when that was seasonal work, and when that was over, well, then we decided we'd go to Marysville and work in the fruit, Modesto and up in there. So the four of us took off and went up there. And, well, we got there too late to get anything at all up there. So we come back, and I don't really remember what he'd done then after we got back. But, in the fall then, in the fall of 38, we had some more friends that had, people we had met that had moved in on Lester Frick's place there with us. They'd come from Oklahoma, and he had a brother living in Shafter. This man did. And he went up to Shafter. And he come back and he said, they're having a strike on the Hoover Ranch up there between Wasco and Shafter. And he said, we can all get a job up there. He said, we've got a job if we want it. He said, the only thing, we're going to have to move in after dark on account of the strikers. And, well, we needed a job. So we moved in about midnight and there and went to work on the Hoover Ranch out there. And so I don't know how long we stayed there, but anyway, this was going on, and I was getting more homesick by the day, crying my eyes out because I couldn't see any family or anything. And in 1941, the summer of 1941, I told him, I said, we are going to work, and we're going to Oklahoma. That was 4 years after we came out here. And I went to work, well, we both did, in the shed, the drying shed, cutting fruit to dry. I cut the fruit and tabled it, and he carried it away and put it in the sulfur houses to dry it, you know.
Where was that?
That was on the Hoover Ranch out between Wasco and Shafter. And I cut fruit for 3 cents a box, lug, the big, you know. And we would stand, and they'd set it up to us, and then they put the pallets that we put them on that were about this big from here. And, you know, we'd just cut them and line them up on there, and then they'd take them away. And I cut their fruit for 3 cents a box, and I don't know what he got. I think it was 25 cents an hour. And but I never worked so hard in all my life, because I wanted to go home. And we left here the 21st day of August, 4 years from the day we left there, going back home.
I wanted to go back just a little bit and see if you could tell me a little bit more about the Sunset Labor Camp in Arvin. You said you were there just a week?
About a week, yes. But we were visiting there. We visited there. The Sunset Labor Camp was really a good place. I mean, it was good for the people because they had a place to go. And it was a clean place, and it was run clean, you know. And they had entertainment there on Saturday night. They had a big dance platform, and they had a dance every Saturday night. And if they didn't have a band, they had a jukebox that they danced by. It was open-air dance platform. And the only way an outsider could get in was to be invited in by somebody that lived there. It was just for the people in the camp. So naturally, we were invited every Saturday night. And at that time, I didn't dance because I was raised very strict in one way. We didn't go to dances. Although my father was a musician, he could play any kind of a musical instrument. And he went out and played for country dances, but we didn't get to go because we weren't allowed to go. So anyway, we didn't. We went to the dances, and my husband danced, but I didn't. I couldn't dance. And we had a lot of fun. It was really a nice place to go, because I don't recall ever know of anybody being there drunk or raising cane or anything like that. And it was just people. It was just like a family because we were all from Oklahoma, Texas, or Arkansas. And we were all there for the same purpose, to try and get out of the depression and make a living and try to, you know, make something. And some of them went on quicker than others, that, you know, and got better jobs than quicker than some of them did. And then I'll admit some of them is probably still living the same way they did then, because there is people that just don't care, and that's the people that give Oklahoma, Texas, and Arkansas the bad name, the Okie name. And so that's why I said that somebody should write another book. And I hope someday that somebody does it.
Do you remember ever visiting or seeing some of the ditch camps or the tent cities? For instance, there was a ditch camp up here in Oildale underneath the bridge.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of those?
I remember seeing them, but I was never around any of them. And then there was a tent city up at around Tulare, I think. In fact, the Grapes of Wrath, that's where some of that was wrote up there. Of course, most of it was filmed in the Ivan labor camp, but they, the Jude family lived up there in that tent city up there. And but I never lived in, but I do remember seeing this one down here on the river there. But as far as ever having anything to do with it, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about living at the Frick Ranch. I've heard some bad things about the Frick Ranch and how it was run and the housing they had. You seem to be pleased with it, though.
With Lester Frick's ranch, there was not a thing in the world wrong. We were all families that lived there, and I never seen a thing in the world wrong with the way mm-hmm. Lester Frick run his. Now, after I left there, I don't know, but when I lived there...
Mm-hmm. Was there another Frick?
Yes, there was. And it seems like I
recall...
I can't remember, but it seemed like I recall in later years after we left Arvin. Something about a controversy over in, but not this, not Lester Frick.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody else, the other Frick. I don't know which one it was.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever work, or your husband work on a Frick ranch?
We picked cotton for Lester Frick. That's when we moved in there. We moved in there to pick cotton. And then they started tried to get a union started that fall of 37. And after we picked for Lester Frick, we got the first picking done, and then we went over to another ranch, and I don't remember which ranch it was, whose it was. And we were picking cotton there, and the strikers would come by and try to get us to, go with them. And, well, I don't really know who was right and who was wrong there. Because at that time, all we were trying to do was make a living. And if we was out on the road where they would come by, we'd pick up our sacks. They kept the trailer parked in the middle of the field, and we would just go to the trailer and wait till they'd leave, and we'd go back to picking cotton in. And like I say, I don't know if we were right or if they were right trying to get the union, if we were right going against it, I don't know. But my husband never worked in a union then. He, from there, he went on to working in welding shops and then in a manufacturing shop in Shafter.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them were never union, so.
Do you remember any names associated with this attempt to organize a union?
The only name I can remember is his cousin that we came out here with, because he got in with them and he tried to tell us, to get us to go with him, but we wouldn't do it. And that's the only name I remember. And his name was Elton Cole. He's eventually went on in when the war started. He went in the war and lost the leg, and he lives in Oklahoma, back in Oklahoma now. But that's the only one I can remember. That
why didn't you and your husband want to join a union?
Because we would have been out of work at that time, and we'd have had to quit work, and we just wanted to work and make a living. We couldn't have lived with, I don't know how we would have lived without it, because those people that were doing that, I don't know how they lived. And so we just stayed out there and picked the cotton, and then when the winter was come on, well, then, like I say, we got help from the welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And until work started up again. And we went on, and we done good. After we came to the Hoover Ranch then, during the slack season there, well, W.B. Camp was leveling some land out on the other side north of Wasco. And my husband had never run one of those land levelers, but he was never a person to stand back and say, I can't do it. I can learn, you know, he'd say. So he went out and got a job leveling land. And it worked for Gideon's Construction Company, leveling that land. And when they got that leveled and Mr. Kemp started farming it, then he hired my husband to work for him. And we moved out on that ranch and stayed out there then. He worked on the farm until our son was born, right after our son was born. He was born in 46. In 47, we worked on other ranches then. And in 1950, well, he went to work on the Maricopa seed farms south of Bakersfield in the shop as a welder. And he stayed there till 53. And then he came back to Shafter and went to work for Mettler's in the welding shop. And then he worked for Frank Russell, too, up until 1970. Yeah, 1970. And we never bought a home. And then in 1970 is when he got sick. And he retired in 71. Then he passed away in 72. He had cancer. He was operated on the first time in September in 1970, and then he passed away in September in 72. And our doctor and hospital bills was over $40,000, so when he passed away, well, that left me with nothing then. Almost back like I was when I first came to Arvin. But I've managed to take care of myself since then. And with the Social Security that he left.
Well, would your husband went from job to job depending on where the work was, and you worked some of the time. Did you work just some of the time or all the time?
No, I just worked in the summertime. I worked in the potato sheds then after we moved back to Shafter. Well, I worked in the potato sheds after my kids got up, the oldest one. After she got up old enough to take care of the two younger ones.
Now, when was your first child born?
She was born July the 17th, 1943. We was married 6 years the day she was born.
Okay. How did your husband know where to find work?
Well, when he got this job at Mettler's, out there in the shop at Shafter, E.M.H. Mettler and Sons, we had been living down south of Bakersfield, and he was working for C.J. Sanders then on the farm. And my brother-in-law over in Marana, Arizona, passed away, and he had a welding shop over there. And so we went over there. My husband was going to take over the welding shop for my sister and run it. And we moved over there. This must have been in 53 or 54. I don't remember which. And it was in 54. And we got over there. And my sister didn't know anything about his business, you know. Well, when we got over there and they got to going through everything, well, my brother-in-law had a partner in there and they didn't know it. And somewhere or other, the partner said everything was signed over to him in case anything, each way, you know, if one of them passed away, the other and got everything. I think he was just pulling a fast one, but there was nothing we could do about it. So we stayed there for a while, and my husband worked, and we come back to Shafter then. And he went over, somebody told him they was wanting truck drivers over at Mettler's place, and he went over there, and they said, no, but we need a welder. And he said, I'm a welder, and he went to work for them.
How about in the 30s when you first came out here, in the late 30s, and you were doing farm work?
Well,
you said you went up to Marysville, but you were too late for work. How did you usually know where to go and at what time?
Well, we knew what time the fruit would, you know, usually about what time the fruit would get ripe, ready to pick and pack and everything, you know, because we had worked on the Hoover Ranch in the fruit, and we picked it and packed it out there, so we knew, and other people was going back and forth too, so it just got around, word got around from the experience that the other people had had. And so when we left to go to Marysville, well, they were still working in the fruit, but they already had all the people they needed. And we were young, and if we'd have stayed around there, we would have probably gotten work. But we decided then we'd go over on the coast around Salinas and Gilroy and over in there. And so we went over there, and we decided, well, there wasn't nothing there. I guess really we wasn't looking too hard for work at that time, because we were just, there was two couples, my husband and I and another couple, and we were all young, and so we came back to Wasco, and we got there late one afternoon, and we went out in the potato fields. They were digging potatoes, and they said yes, we could pick up potatoes the next day to be there. So we stayed that night, and we slept beside the road at the potato field.
Mm-hmm. Is that the way you usually did when you had to move from one town to another?
No.
Beside the road?
No. Sometimes we did because we wanted to. I mean, it was an adventure for us.
Yeah.
I know we went to the Tagus Ranch one time. They had places for us to go there. They had cabins there. But they decided we'd, you know, camp out. But we picked up potatoes there, and then we eventually went back to Arvin and then back to Shafter, and we lived there then.
Mm-hmm. How about the money for the gas and the food when you were going from place to place? Had you saved up money for the
previous
job?
Yes, because at that time gas was only about 10 cents a gallon, and a gallon of gas would, even in the big old car we had, would get twice as far as it does for a new car now. And so we didn't really, I mean, two couples together, so it didn't cost us so much for gas. And but eventually we settled down and started raising a family and stayed in one place then.
Did you find that when you were going from job to job that you had enough money for everything you needed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. Now, the first year we were living down there at Arvin, that winter, it got kind of rough. Like I say, the welfare helped us, and we never went hungry, though. Now, I believe there was people that did, but we didn't. At one time, our money was getting low, and we didn't have any welfare assistance, and my father-in-law went out, and I don't know where the place was, I never saw it, but he went to see this rancher, and he let him clean the reservoir out, my father-in-law and my husband and my brother-in-law. And that was enough money. See, we didn't have to pay any rent or utilities on those ranches. It was all furnished for us at that time. So really all we had to do was just buy groceries, which very few clothes we bought. And so they made money of cleaning that reservoir. And I know we spent every penny of it buying groceries and, you know, putting them away so we would have them to last us through the winter. And then we got assistance. I think it was only one time that we got assistance from the welfare. And that was just before the spring work opened up, and then they all went to work.
What did you usually do during the off season when there was no work?
Well, if it was we wasn't very far from the foot of the mountains, and we'd go up in the mountains if the weather was pretty and spend the day up there and climb the mountains and just anything we could. I mean, not like it is now. I have to have something to do like this here to keep my stuff going. But then we'd play cards and just sit around. And but I couldn't do that now. We had and really we didn't have any worries then, because like, well, a friend of mine, we were talking the other night, she said we didn't have anything, but we didn't owe anything. So we really didn't have any worries. We had a place to live and enough food to get by on. And we weren't the only ones. It was everybody that, and there was, I guess, millions of them came from back Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas out here at that time.
How would you compare your situation to other Okies, especially those with children? Do you think you were better off?
Yes, we were. I think so. I think one reason that I got by so well was because I didn't realize the situation of things, because I had been lived in back with my parents, you know, grown up where we had nothing to worry about. We had a big family. We didn't have a lot, but we didn't have anything to worry about then. So I went into my marriage with the same idea that somewhere or other I would be provided for. And we came right on to California, so I didn't really worry. My parents worried more than I did. I found out later. Because they was afraid I was going hungry and this and that, and I was the only one of the family that was out here at that time. And I told them, I said, well, you didn't have to worry about me. I was taking care of myself. So, but there was people with large families that I guess really had it rough, because I know in later years I had met a family that had about 8 kids, and that poor woman, I just felt so sorry for her. We were living down south of Bakersfield on Maricopa Seed Farms then, and but her husband was nothing but a drunkard, and that's something my husband didn't do. And they just had a terrible time. They had a rough time then, and but we never did really have it rough, because my husband, like I say, he always provided for us then after we had our family. We had 3 kids. But after we got over the depression and got settled down into a job, then I'll say in 38 that my husband was never without a job over 3 days at a time. And I've seen people that back in the 40s before the war and say, oh, I just can't find work nowhere. Well, he never had a hard time finding work, because it's there if you want it. Mm-hmm. And it's there now if you want it.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the farm work you did, about how the system worked? For instance, if you were picking fruit or potatoes or whatever, how would they pay you?
I picked up potatoes down at, well, let's go back to the cotton first, because that's the first thing we done. Okay, they paid us by the 100 pounds, you know. I don't remember what it was at first. I know it wasn't very much. Probably a dollar or a hundred, if it was that much. Might have been just 90 cents. And if you picked 100 pounds, you made 90 cents. But each time you went to weigh up, they didn't give you money. They gave you a paper script. It was about 2-inch square. And they had a, I guess it was a typewriter. They marked on it how much you weighed, how much that sack weighed, how much you was getting, and how much it was 100 pounds, you know. And then at the end of the day, you could cash them in and get your money, or you could save them as long as you wanted to. And so we picked that way. We'd sometimes we'd have to cash them all in at the end of the day. Sometimes we could save some to the weekend where we'd have more money. And then we went from that to picking up potatoes. We were paid by the sack to pick potatoes. And we got paid at the end of the week for that. And then we, of course, we cut grapes, and we were paid by the tray to dry, cut the raisin grapes. And we were paid by the tray for that. So it all depended on how fast you was doing this, how much money you made. And
do you remember the growers ever taking advantage of you or trying to cheat you?
Never. I don't remember ever being taken advantage of, cheated, or anything. I don't know, maybe they've done some people that way, but I was never never mistreated, taken advantage of, because I, like I say, the farmers that we work for down there at Arvin were just wonderful people. And Mr. Cobb that we work for, and then Jack Stoltz, his son-in-law, I met his wife. She became a widow right after I did. And we were both going to a singles club. And I met her there, and I asked her, I said, "Are you Jack Stoltz's wife?" And she said, "Yes." And I told her who I was. And we have become real good friends. She's not, I don't know if she's as old as I am. I doubt it, if she's as old as I am. Hazel Stoltz, have you ever heard of her? Well, she lives, I don't know where she lives, but she used to work at that Sunset House there in Valley Plaza, but she don't work anywhere now. But she is just a wonderful person, and she, but anyway, we became good friends after meeting again at the, well, I had never met her, but I told her who I was, and of course, naturally, she didn't remember my husband, but I told her, you know, we work for her husband, and so we have become real good friends. I see her occasionally now. And she's, I suppose, got anything she wants, you know, because when he died, I think she said she sold their ranch, and she lives in a condominium around here somewhere. But, you know, she goes over to the senior citizens over here in Oraldale, that, and down at the place in the park down here, to that place where the senior citizens have dances. And she just works with everybody down there. She is so good to work with senior citizens. Of course, she's a senior citizen too, but she just, I mean, she can just get around and make everybody feel so welcome, and she stands right at the door and welcomes everybody as they come in. And she's a hostess, you know, at the place. And but as far as anybody ever taking advantage of us, no, they did not.
Do you remember hearing about other people that were taken advantage of?
Well, I remember hearing about it, but I can't remember who it was or anything. They said they took advantage of them down there in the labor camp when they first come out here, but I never seen anything in the world that I would say that they took advantage of them. because they were all so nice, and to me, if they couldn't help you, they didn't do anything to go against you, because they were just really good to us, and letting us work and everything. So I can't see anywhere where anybody was taken advantage of.
Well, you were talking about when you lived on a Hoover ranch and you went there to work because there was a strike. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? Did you have any trouble with the strikers? Did you ever come face to face with them?
No.
Have any trouble?
No, we didn't. Like I say, we moved in after 10 o'clock at night. We all loaded our cars up in Oregon, and we came and we stayed outside a chapter there until after 10 o'clock. And then we went down one at a time, one carload at a time, and there was the foreman on the ranch and at the railroad track where we had to cross to go into the ranch, standing there, letting us cross the railroad track into the ranch. They had houses for us to live in, and we went to work immediately. My husband did. Then I think it was they were pruning trees then, and we never had a bit of trouble. Apparently that strike must have just died out, because the people that were striking, I guess they seen they couldn't do anything by moving people in like that, and they started pruning the trees, which there hadn't any of them. They had to teach them to prune trees. And then, like I say, we picked the fruit. They did, and dried it or packed it. I dried the fruit, cut it to dry, and I packed fruit too, which that time I didn't pack much fruit because it was on a belt, and at that time I'd get dizzy when that belt would come around and roll over, you know. And so I just went back to the drying shed and worked there. But I never had a bit of trouble. We didn't, not a bit.
This is an interview with Clara Davis for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Stacy Jagels at 733rd Street, Apartment D, on Thursday, February 12, 1981 at 9:30 a.m.
In the last session, when we were talking about the Hoover Ranch, you said you didn't have any problems there when you went on the ranch. But I was wondering if you heard about other people that did have some problems.
Well, we heard talk because, we were living at Arvin, and this friend of ours came up to Shafter to visit his brother, and he came back and told us that we could go in there and work, but we would have to go in after dark because there was problems there. But we never had any problems at all. We went in one night, went to work the next morning, and we lived there for 4 or 5 years and never had any problems at all there. Mm-hmm. I worked in the summertime, and my husband worked the year around there. So, but I did hear, they said that there was problems, but I never, never seen any problems at all.
Mm-hmm. Did you know any of the people that were strikers there?
No, I didn't. I met people that was living there when we moved in, and they were there when the strike started, but they didn't participate in the strike. The strikers were all gone. Then I don't know how long they stayed there, but they were all gone when we went to work there. So but the ones that were living there didn't participate in the strike.
Mm-hmm. And during that whole time in the late 30s, there were quite a few newspaper articles written about the strikes and attempts at unionization, and generally just about farm working in the Okies. Do you remember reading newspapers then and reading things like that?
No, I didn't read very many newspapers then, although I've been a reader all my life. My whole family has. We're great readers. But I didn't read newspapers then. I guess the main reason was that we just didn't have money to buy a newspaper. and we were too busy working trying to make a living. But I had my husband's cousin was participating in trying to get this union down at Irvine, and we heard about it from him. But we didn't, we wasn't interested in it because we wanted to make a living, and we knew that if we took part in the strike, there would be no work for us for we didn't know how long. And we were just barely surviving like everybody else. So we didn't take any interest in it at all then. And
do you remember any specific things that your cousin told you about the unions?
Well, he just told us that they would be better wages and that we would have help from the unions, which I didn't believe at the time. And I don't know anything about unions because my husband never belonged to a union, but I didn't believe at that time that the unions would help if they were on strike, if they got this union, you know, for farm workers, because I didn't see how they could help. And so we just weren't interested in them at all. But he finally gave it up himself and just went on and worked with us. Which was what everybody done, because they never did get a union back in the 30s. Well, they don't even have a union now for farm workers. They've never had, as far as I know, a union for farm workers except the Cesar Chavez. He's got his union now. But until then, I never known them. I had never, although they did try. And they tried awful hard because they worked awful hard for it. And I admire the people for what they done. But like I said, we weren't interested.
Could you explain why your cousin and why the other people were interested in it? It seems to me that they had to feed themselves and their family just as much as you did, and they weren't very well off either. What made them
well,
take a chance in doing that?
I don't know what the other people done, but my cousin was... shall I say, sort of a radical. He could be talked into anything where he didn't have to work if he thought he could get out of work. So that was, in my opinion, that was the only reason that he went along with them, was because he just wanted to be a Mr. Know-it-all and try to get something for nothing. He's still that way. But he then, in 42, he went in the service then. And he went to Germany, and he lost a leg in the war. So he's a war veteran living in Oklahoma City right now. And but he still works. He has an antique clock business in Oklahoma City. So... I don't suppose he ever got in a union of any kind unless, well, he couldn't be in any union at all now because he works for himself.
You were talking about when you first came to California, there were not as nearly as many jobs as you had been told there were. And you even described one job where you had to go and pick a number in order to work. Can you give me a little bit more of an idea how you found the jobs and how you and your husband and the people you were with always seemed to find work when there were very few jobs?
Well, the job where he had to go and get the number to work was at DiGiorgio Ranch down out of Irvine there. And we were living in Irvine, and we knew it was the season time for work, you know, for the fruit. And word got around from one to the other that DiGiorgio was hiring, and they would go out there every morning. And have to stand around to get a number to get inside to work because they just hired so many people every morning. And there was a huge crowd there every morning. And this was a picking fruit. And my husband, like I said, he finally just pushed his way up and reached up and got a number and went in and got a job and went to work there. But the seasonal work, you learned when it was from other people going up and down the valley, because it was over here, the work, seasonal work was over here, the fruit work when it was all over with. Well, then it was starting in Stanislaus County up around Modesto, and it was fruit work up there, the sheds, the packing sheds, the canneries, and all. And people would just automatically load up their cars and go up there when the work was over here. Now, there was flyers sent out, they tell me, but I don't remember ever seeing them, telling where the work was, when it would open up, and where the places were to live. Like the Tagus Ranch, that's in Tulare County. And they would go, I know Tagus would send out flyers, but I can't recall ever seeing any of them. And that when the work would start, well, they had places for people to live. Well, they would leave us Kern County and go to Tulare County, too, for the Tagus Ranch, then on to Modesto, then on to Marysville. And then some would go over on the coast around Salinas and San Jose over in there. Then in August, I know one year in August, we went to San Jose to pick prunes. And we stayed up there for, I guess, about 6 weeks. And I'm trying to think what year this was. I can't recall what year it was. In the early 40s, so within. We didn't have any children then, so we was free to go if we wanted to, you know. And
I've heard that some people were lucky enough to retain, say, a permanent home here in Kern County and then follow the crops when they could and eventually come back to Kern County. Did you do that, or did you have a temporary home each place you went?
At first we had a temporary home, but then we had our home here. And we'd come back to it.
About how many months of the year would you be traveling around to other crops in the valley?
Well, we didn't travel so much as most people did. I'd say we were gone about 5 months. And then, of course, we worked in the potatoes here in Kern County. And then we, after we went to the Hoover Ranch, well, we just quit completely traveling then. And then we moved from there to W.B. Kemp's Ranch out north of Wasco. We worked out there, and that's where our oldest daughter was born, when we lived there. And he worked on that ranch. Then our son was born. Our daughter was born in 1943, and our son was born in 1946 on the Hoover Ranch. And then we went down south of Bakersfield in 1947, down to Maricopa Flats, what they call the Maricopa Flats. We was down on Maricopa Seed Farms, and our other daughter was born down there. And we lived there 3 years, and then we came back to Shafter.
Back to when you were, before you had your children,
yeah.
And you were moving around, because you didn't have children, and you weren't you didn't have the responsibilities of keeping them in school and, mm-hmm. And taking care of them. Did you find the moving around and new experiences and new places kind of exciting?
Oh, yes, it was. Because I was born and raised in one place. And we seldom ever, in the summertime, we took a week's vacation and went to a place called Turner Falls in Oklahoma. My dad sent us down there to camp out a week. And then later in August of the year, we would go back for another week when we had a family reunion. And we never went anywhere else out of town. And after I came to California, well, I guess I was just thrilled with it all to go from one place to the other for several years. And then, of course, like I say, when we started having our family, then we settled down. But it was a wonderful experience for anybody, I think, that was living out here in the 30s until the war started. And I think most people started settling down then. But of course, there's still some that goes now.
Yeah. There weren't very many people that were as lucky as you were. Most of the people I've talked to or that I've read about had children.
Yeah, they did.
And many times when they were trying to follow the crops, they would arrive too late for a crop or too early. Or perhaps there were enough workers and they didn't need any more. And they really had a rough time of it. Do you remember seeing people, say, in ditch camps by the road or... Even on the ranches that were a lot worse off?
Yes, because we had friends like that had children that was school age, and they just would go and camp by the road, and most of them, like you say, would get there too late or too early. I mean, not most of them, but some of them would get there too late or too early, and... Then it was, I'm sure, a problem of trying to get the kids in school and then maybe work 3 or 4 weeks and have to take them out and go somewhere else and put them in another school. I just don't see how they'd done it, but they did. And they took it in their stride. It wasn't too much of a problem to them because... It was times like it was in the 30s, and they had to make a living the best way they could. And so they just... But eventually, now, there is kids that I know of that was drugged around that way, and that's the way I'm going to say it. They were drugged from one camp to the other. And they went on and went through school and got an education and are doing real good. But then there's others that I know of that failed somewhere along the line. But we didn't have any children, and it was easier on us. And I think back sometimes, and I think, well, it was foolish for us to do like we did, but I can't. It's quite an experience, and I wouldn't take for it. I can look back and see that I wouldn't have missed it. Because we really enjoyed it. We were young and then we settled down and started raising our family. But it was quite an experience.
You said that you and your husband were always able to find work. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that you thought that people who wanted to work could find work.
That's right. And I felt back then the same way. If they wanted work, they could find it. If they would look hard enough and long enough and far enough. It was hard sometimes to get from Bakersfield to Tulare, but everybody tried to help everybody else that wanted help and needed help, that wanted to get to another job. So there was a lot of people that just came into Bakersfield, Irvin, mostly in Lamont, and sit down and sit there and would work a little while and then go to welfare, depend on welfare to see them through the winter. Well, we didn't do that. Now, we had welfare help one time, the first winter we were in California. We didn't do that. We found work. If we couldn't go somewhere else to the work, to another town or another county, well, they would get out and they'd find maybe a day's work here, they'd get paid for that, and somewhere else the next day they'd go another farmer and say, well, I'll go over to this farmer, you might get some work over there. And sometimes we'd go for a week without any work, but we had enough to live on. So it wasn't because he didn't want the work, it was just at times there was no work to do, because like in the wintertime when the weather was bad, it was raining and there wasn't anything to do. And we'd go out, we'd pick cotton, even in the winter when it was raining and cold, and as soon as it'd get a little bit dry, well, we'd jump out and we'd pick enough cotton to keep us for a day or two then. So I wouldn't take for those experiences I had at all. I wouldn't take anything for them, because they taught me a lot. I was raised in a large family, but we were raised close at home, and our dad took care of us. We babysat, as girls did, and things like that. But then he would not let us get out and do work on the farm like chopping cotton. He would never let us do that, and he would never let us work in a cafe, because back in the early 30s, I assumed from the way he talked when I would want to work in a cafe that if a girl worked in a cafe, she didn't have a very good reputation. So we never done that. And after getting married and coming to California, well, all this was a whole new world to me, opened up to me. And I have never told any of my family about my experiences in California. They know nothing about them, because they weren't out here, and they were living back in Oklahoma in their secure lives, and I was running from place to place trying to make a living, and they never know anything about it. Mm-hmm. Someday I will tell them about them, but I haven't never told them about them yet.
And just a minute ago, we were talking about some of the Okies that just didn't try hard enough to find work. Do you think there were very many like that?
Not too many. The biggest majority of them wanted to work, wanted to make a living, wanted to have a home and for their family. But there was some that the wine was cheap, and they had never seen anything like that before, especially down there at they could go to the wineries down there at Kovacevich Winery and take a bottle and buy their wine for, I don't know, very little. We didn't buy it, we did know what was going on with those people. And they just got to where they became a wino. And
do you think that had a lot to do with why some of them weren't finding work,
because
they had problems with alcoholism?
Mm-hmm. I think it was because they just couldn't give up that wine.
Did you know very many people like that?
Well, not too many. I knew one family there. There was this elderly lady and her two sons. And one of them tried to take care of his mother and work, and the other one, he became a wino. And then after I moved to Shafter, well, they had relatives in Shafter, and I met their relatives. Well, they're all wonderful people that I know out there, you know. But this one, he just became a typical wino. Now, we had a friend of ours living with us. He wasn't married. And he worked all the time right along with us. And usually it was, the best I can remember, it was just single boys, you know, that would get on that wine. Some men, married men did too. But this guy that lived with us, he didn't. And he is living in Sacramento now, and he's worked at one of the schools in Sacramento ever since he got out of the service years ago. And he's still a good friend. We run around with him. He was our friend in Oklahoma, and he came out after we did. And
do you think that there were any more Okies that became winos or alcoholics than, say, blacks or other Caucasians who are already here in California, or Mexicans or any other kind of group?
Well, I don't know, because at that time there wasn't so many Mexicans or blacks either. I mean, out where we lived, ran on the farms.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a few Mexicans around Arvin. Mostly it was Filipinos around Arvin. And they all worked. They had, what do they call them, bunk houses, where the Filipinos lived, because most of them were single. Well, I guess all of them were. And they lived in these bunk houses and worked on these places. And they worked in the grapes, which we did too. That is another thing we done. And so it was more Filipinos that we've seen than we did Mexicans and blacks.
How about other Caucasians that already lived here in California? Do you think more Okies were alcoholics than other white people that were already here?
I don't know. Well, you know, there's people that drinks all the time that keeps it hid. So you just couldn't say. And a wino didn't care. All they wanted was another bottle of wine and down on the riverbank. So I just really don't know.
I was also thinking that because many of the women in the families were oftentimes very religious, that this could have really presented a problem where the man was spending the money to go out and drink. Here was a woman trying to raise a family.
Yeah. Well, I knew several families like that, but the women just went right on to church, took their children and went right on to church. Now, I was raised in church back home before I came to California, back in Oklahoma. But after we came to California, well, then I quit going to church for a long time because we were moving around. And as you know, it's kind of hard to say, well, this is Sunday night, I have to get up early in the morning, so I'm not going to bother going to church. And then maybe the next week you'd be in another town and you didn't know where a church was to go to. But then after we had our family, well, and the kids got up big enough to go, sometimes I'd take them, sometimes I'd send them. But I started my kids going to church when they were very small. So
do you think most other people in your position, most people from Oklahoma that came out during the 30s were very religious and did go to church when they could?
I think that the people, when they came from Oklahoma, the biggest majority of them were religious people. But then they come to California and a lot of them just seemed to put church out of their mind and they didn't go. But then some of them did stay in church. But I think there was more, and I'm saying this with my experience with the people that I knew. I think there was more quit going to church than there was that stayed in church that was very religious about their church in Oklahoma before they left there. And they, when they come out here, they just forgot it, I guess. And like I say, we all lived out, well, the Arvin labor camp, Sunset labor camp now. I believe that they had, I'm sure they did, they had church services on Sunday in that camp for the people that wanted to go. And of course, we didn't live there long. We only lived there about a week at that time, and we moved out south of Arvin, where it was so hard to get into town, because at that time, we didn't, my husband and I didn't have a car. We just had to depend on his cousin. And so eventually, oh, we got a car. Well, but then we was making pretty good money, and so we just decided to drive around, you know, see what we hadn't seen in the mountains and places. Instead of going to church, well, it was more or less sightseeing trips on Sunday. And then when we'd go somewhere else, well, it was the same way. So I think the biggest majority of the people were that way too, because all this was new to them, and they had come out here with high hopes, because the flowers had been sent back to Oklahoma. I didn't see any, but the flowers had been sent back there to that there was, you know, all kinds of work and good money to be made out here. Well, when we got out here, it wasn't here. Or there was too many people for each job or something like that, because it just, the work wasn't like they had it in the flowers when they sent them back to Oklahoma.
We were just talking about the high hopes that people had when they came out mm-hmm. from Oklahoma. Do you think very many were disappointed as a general rule?
Well, I think they were, but they took it in their stride. The ones, like I said, that really wanted to do anything, make a living, did. It was a poor living, but until things got better, you know, but they managed to make a living for their families and feed and clothe them. And some of them didn't even have cars, but other people did, so everybody shared like that. When I remember one time we had the car, and somebody told them that they could go to work at Kernville. I don't remember, I mean, there was jobs open at Kernville, and I don't remember what it was. It must have been in the logging up there. And we had this big old car, I think I told you about it, this 1928 Grand Page, and it was a huge car. So there was about seven or eight men all went together and bought the gas to go to Kernville in our car. And which didn't take much gas or very much money, because gas was only about 15 cents a gallon. And well, they went up there, and that there was no work up there, but they had to go see, because it was the only way they was going to find work, is to go and see about it. Well, they didn't get a job when they went up there, and that's the way they would go, you know, all get in one car and go together to look for work.
Well, if people were somewhat disappointed in the employment prospects out here, do you think in general they were glad that they came to California?
I think, no, I don't. Because there were so many people I talked to, so many, you know, we talked. And if they could have had the money, they would have went back to Oklahoma or Arkansas or Texas, wherever they came from. At that time, they would have went back, because they were so disappointed in the work, the conditions, the living conditions and everything, because we weren't used to seeing things like that, like this, the labor camp down there. That amazed me when I saw that for the first time, because I had never seen anything like that in my life. And because they don't have them in Oklahoma or Texas or anywhere back there. And I really believe that there was a people that would have went back if they could have got the money to went back on. And I know I would have went back, and all I would have had done is wrote to my father and told him I wanted to come home. But I wouldn't do it. I was 19 years old, and you have no idea how homesick I was, how many tears I shed, and it was 4 years before I ever got to go back. But I didn't ask him for a penny. And I finally made it, we made it on our own and went back 4 years later.
Do you think very many people did go back permanently?
Not too many. Now, those that did go back, I don't think you could ever get them back to California. I was on vacation in Texas, in East Texas this summer, and our car was having car trouble. We were way out in the country there, and there's a little garage beside the road, so we pulled in there. And my two sisters, they just got out and went inside and sat down, you know, under the cooler. Well, me, I've got to worry about things. So I was out there trying to help him see what's the matter with the car, and he asked me where we were going, and I told him we were going to Hemp Hill, Texas, which was only about 30 miles down the road, and I told him, I said, I'm from California, and one sister's from Oklahoma, and one's from Dallas. And he said that he came to California at one time. I don't know when it was, he didn't say. And he said, I got out there, and he said, I never hated a place so bad in my life. And he said, I went to church, and I got down, and I prayed. And I said, Lord, if you'll just get me back to Texas, I promise you I'll never go back to California again. He said, well, I had to go back one time to Modesto. His sister was sick, and he had to come back out here. And I told him, I said, well, California's not like it was back then. And he said, I don't care, I'd never go back there again. So the people that went back then, they've still got the idea it's like now, like it was then. And
can you think of what other things bothered them so much? Besides just not being able to find work, were there other things about California that upset people, that disappointed people?
I think it was the way they had to live. They didn't... I mean, I'm speaking from my own experience. I didn't like the way we had to live. I made the best of it. I didn't let it worry me or upset me. But and at times it was fairly, well, was, I wouldn't say nice, but it was fun the way we were living. Because like a lot of the other people, we could just stop on the side of the road and sleep. And then you could do that, and nothing would bother you. We had no fears of anything. And we would, the people with families, of course, they had their cooking facilities with them, and they'd cook by the side of the road. And we would make coffee. That's about all we ever done by the side of the road was make coffee. But the people with families, of course, they had to cook everywhere they went. They couldn't afford to eat any other way.
What were some of the things that you missed so much about Oklahoma? Probably your mom and dad and your family.
My family, uh-huh. And my friends, because I had, all of my friends were back there, my girlfriends that I grew up with. And then my best girlfriend came to California, and she was down in the Los Angeles area. And she wrote and gave me her address. And we had never been in Los Angeles. And
I told my husband, I said, we're going to see her. It took us nearly all day to find her, but I found her. But she lives back in Texas now. She went back there, and she won't come back out here. But her sister lives in Santa Paula, and she won't, like me, she won't go back there and live. So we stayed out here, her sister and I, and we've bought it out and have lived here. But she didn't stay. She went back. So I think all the people that went back during those times would never come back. I don't think any of them would. In fact, some of my sisters were out here, and they live back there now. They just stayed a little while and went back. And
from the way you described the town you grew up in, it sounded like a smallish town, probably a very tight community where you knew most of the other people there, most of the merchants.
Oh, yes,
the teachers,
I knew.
The minister.
Uh-huh.
And when you came out to California, even if you had just stayed in one spot, it was a larger, spread out community. Did you miss that feeling of belonging to a town?
Yes.
Had in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh. But I run on to several families, and they used to say if you're from Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, you didn't have any problems out here because half the people out here were from Paul's Valley. And I did. I knew a lot, and I still know them, you know. In fact, I've got friends out in Shafter now that's lived there, been out here since I have, back in the 30s. And they're from my hometown. And at one time, we counted 11 families. We lived in the North Shafter camp then. And we counted 11 families from Paul's Valley that lived there. They were relatives, but they were 11 different families living there from Paul's Valley. I could probably name you half a dozen families right here in Bakersfield from Paul's Valley right now. So I never see them. Some of them I know their names, and that's all. And some of them are friends. I've got a friend over just off of South Union out there by the fairgrounds that I grew up with in Paul's Valley. And then he married a distant cousin of mine. And I haven't seen those people in nearly 10 years. I talk to them occasionally on the phone, but that's all. So there's a lot of people from Paul's Valley.
When you said you were a young girl growing up and you would kind of dream about California and wish that you could come out here, you also said that you had heard about California from people who had already come out before that. Do you remember what sorts of things you heard that made you want to come here so much?
One thing, before I married, now my husband was one that had me interested in California. We weren't married then, but... really, I don't know where he was getting his source of information about California, but that was all our talk. This friend I was telling you about that lives off South Union, the two of them, and then the other friend that lived with us, the three of them, and they was coming to California. Well, we were the first ones to come, but my sister came to California before I was married, and her husband came out with his family, and then she came out later on the bus, and I think it took her nearly a week on that bus to come to California. This was in 1936, and my dad told her to call back every time the bus stopped somewhere where she had, you know, time to get on the phone, because she was the first one that ever came out here, got that far away from home. And she came to Wasco, and she stayed for a while, and then she got pregnant. And so she wrote and told my parents she was pregnant. Well, they insisted that she come home. So they came back, her and her husband came back, and she said that she didn't ever want to come back out here again. Well, then she had her baby, she had twin girls in May in 1937, and I married in July in 37 and came to California in August in 37. Well, then in 1938, she came back to California and lived in Madeira, and she's never went back either. She and I are the only ones that's still out here. She lives in Riverside now. And but I had three sisters besides her to come out here. Two of them's in Oklahoma.
When she came back to Oklahoma, did she tell you favorable things about California? Things that made you want to come here?
No. She said she would never come back. She hated the place. She lived in Wasco and she hated the place.
Nothing favorable then. Just all negative.
Uh-huh. And but then in 1938 she came back and has lived here since.
Mm-hmm. I thought maybe she said something to make you want to come.
No. It was just my husband and the friends talking. We run around together for 4 years because we went together 4 years before we married, and it was always our talk that when we could get married, we were going to go to California.
Did you have a general impression of what California was like? Perhaps what it looked like?
Yes, but it wasn't like I've seen it when I got here. And I just can't recall what kind of an impression I did have before I got here, what it was going on in my mind. Because when I come off of that Bear Mountain down into Oregon, that was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. The way those farms are laid out down there, you know. Of course, back in Oklahoma, you know, where you get out here and you run up the side of a hill and down a hill farming, or just, they don't level land too much back there. And they don't irrigate, so they didn't have to have their land level like they do out here. And so all the ideas that I had in my head about it, I guess, went out when I saw that Arvin for the first time.
How about when you first came across the border into California, probably into the desert? That must have been disappointing. That probably didn't seem at all what you thought California was.
No, it didn't. And we stopped out there on the desert out around Needles to help those people fix the car. And they were broke down. And it was in August. But, you know, I can't recall it being too hot out there then. And I know you can go out across there in August now, and whoo! But I don't recall the heat so bad out there. It was early in the morning when we stopped, about daylight, when we seen these people, and we stopped. Of course, they had the car fixed in just a little while, so we didn't sit out there on the desert like some people did. I know I had one sister that came to California, and they were back over in Arizona. And their car broke down on the desert out there in Arizona somewhere, and coming from Blythe into Desert Center. And she just about died. She had two small sons, and it just about killed them out there. But we never had problems like that.
How about when you came into the border? Do you remember having to stop?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what happened then?
Mm-hmm. They went through our car with a fine tooth comb. And we had been, we had picked some cotton in Oklahoma just before we left. We had cotton sacks. So we knew we could pick cotton in California, so we brought those cotton sacks with us. They took them away from us at the border. They wouldn't let us have them on account of the boll weevil. They were afraid we'd bring it from Oklahoma to California. They took that away from us, and there was some. Now this is where the black people. We was parked at the inspection place. right behind a carload of black people coming across. And they had some food. And they was going to take that away from them. And these people said, no, we're going to sit down here and eat everybody this. They had potato salad. I remember that. I remember that girl sitting there eating that potato salad. And they eat every bit of their food. They wouldn't let them take it away, which I don't blame them. But they took our cotton sacks, and I suppose that's all they took from us. But then when we got over here and got a job picking cotton, well, Lester Frick bought cotton sacks for us.
Mm-hmm. When they took them away from you at the border and when they asked to take the other people's food, did you feel that that was unnecessary, that they were rude or...
No, because...
Not treating you very well?
No, because I was raised... The way my parents raised me was that people in authority like that, they know more about what they're doing than I do. So, to me, they just knew what they were doing, so they had to take those sacks. And it didn't bother me a bit that they were rude. They weren't rude or anything. One of my sisters tells me I'm just too easy on the world anyway, but I've got along pretty good being that way. But I can't see, even if a person is rude to you, I can't see being rude back to them just because they're that way. Because I wasn't raised that way. And one time we had been back to Oklahoma, and my mother and father-in-law was with us, and he had got some plants of some kind in Oklahoma. And before we got to the border, he took them out of the car and put them in his pocket so he could get across with them. I don't remember what it was, but I don't know if they would have taken it from him or not, but he wanted that, whatever it was he had brought from Oklahoma. And so they didn't, but they didn't take too many things away from people. Because people didn't have very many things to bring with them.
Did you ever hear about the Los Angeles sheriff going to the border in California and stopping some of the Okies?
I heard about it, yes. Uh-huh. I heard that he went to Yuma at the border and Needles, too. I don't know if he done it or not. But I'm pretty sure that he tried to do it the best I can remember. And then reading about it years later, I read a book, and I can't remember what it was, about down in the Imperial Valley. And it wasn't the Grapes of Wrath, it was something else. About the sheriff going down there and trying to stop the people from coming in. And I just can't remember what that book was, but I would give anything in the world if I could remember and get it again and read it. But we never had any problems like that. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you ever think of going someplace other than California?
No.
It was always California that sort of a magical...
There was only, when I was a child growing up, there was only one other place that I wanted to go to in my childhood, one place I wanted to go to, and that was Galveston, Texas. Because I had a friend, a girlfriend, and her father worked for the railroad, and they got a free train ride to Galveston, Texas every summer. And so about 5 years ago, something like that, I went to Galveston, Texas. And I said, gee, this dirty old place. And then down at Arvin, has anybody ever told you about in the 30s there, how the flowers were on the side on the mountain? And well, see, we lived there, and the people could go not only up the Bear Mountain Boulevard up out of the mountain, but they could go what was that, Tejon Ranch. They would open the gates and let people go in there on the weekends to see those flowers. They were just beautiful. They were that the whole mountainside. We could stand in our yard and see the flowers blooming, but we always went up there. But in the spring, it was just car after car after car of people going up there, and they let them in through there to drive up there and see the flowers, which they won't do now. But it was a beautiful place, and we spent a lot of time. I never took any pictures. I don't know why I didn't. I guess I just didn't think of it. But it was the people from everywhere came up there to see the flowers, which they still do, but they don't get to see them like they did then, enjoy them like they did then. Because you could take a picnic lunch and go up there on the side of that mountain and sit there all day long and have a picnic. That's what we would do a lot of times. And it was the most beautiful place you'd ever see. I know the people think Arvin, Lamont, and Weed Patch, that's Okie-Tans. Maybe it is Okie-Tans, but it was a beautiful place as Arvin was then. And I haven't been to Arvin in years, but I'm sure Arvin is a good town, just like all the rest of small towns around here. The people from Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas made the towns. They built them up, and they own their homes there, and they've lived there for 40 years, over 40 years. So I have nothing to say against any of the towns, and I don't like to hear anybody else call them Okie-Tans, because you don't have to be from Oklahoma, Texas, or Arkansas to be an Okie. In the definition of Okie, it's trash. Well, we're not trash. I'll grant you there are some down there in those towns and all the rest of them that is trash, but they've made themselves what they are. And they didn't have to do it because they could have come out of it like the rest of us did. There was no need for people to go on down in the trash, in the gutter, like some of them did. And given Oklahoma, Texas, and Arkansas the bad name that they gave them. And those people are, I don't feel sorry for them.
Do you think that perhaps there are just as many people that are white trash that didn't come from Oklahoma? They came from some other place.
I do, yes.
But because of the circumstances at the time,
they
the
were
word Okie. Seem to be synonymous
yeah,
with white trash.
Because Okie is just a short form for Oklahoma word for anarchy and a Tex. But there was people from other places that never seen either one of the three states that is just trashy as people that left there in the Depression and came out here. And went down with them, just like when they lived down here on the river. There was people that wasn't from those three states. And there was one woman I knew from my hometown. She still lives around Bakersfield here somewhere. But she wouldn't tell people that she was from Oklahoma because she didn't want them calling her Okies. And she'd tell him she was from Arizona, and I told her, I said, well, what's the difference? People come from Oklahoma to Arizona and then on to California. But she didn't want to tell people she was from Oklahoma. Well, I'm proud of Oklahoma. I've lived here most of my life, but I'm proud of that state. It's a beautiful state. And I'm proud to be from the state.
When they started using the term Okie, in the 30s, did it, at that time, did it immediately have a negative connotation? If they called each other Okies, did that mean trash at the time?
A lot of people resented that, being called an Okie or an Arkie. They did. They resented it. I didn't give it much thought at all, one way or the other, because I didn't live in the labor camp there too long, and that's where they, most the Okies and the Arkies lived there, as they called them that. And people will say, and they still say it now, they call somebody does something, and well, that's just a stupid Okie. You know, well, we're not stupid. Some of them are, but...
do you think maybe the use of the word has changed through the years?
Yeah.
That perhaps it was used in one way in the 30s, and now it's used even worse now?
Well,
does
I don't...
Does it have a more negative connotation
I don't know. Now, I seldom ever hear the word now. So, except, like, just... Now, my girls... They were born and raised here, but they'll say something about a stupid Okie every once in a while, which that's just talk with them. And outside of that, I never hear anybody called an Okie anymore. Now, when my son got married, he married a girl from Arkansas. And I was in Oklahoma at the time. I had to be back there. My mother was ill. And they were married in November of 64, but I came home for Christmas. And she, I had met her, but she was awfully shy, I guess. And she still doesn't know how to take me and the girls sometimes, but she says she's getting with us now. But anyway, we were cooking. I come home and I was cooking Christmas dinner. We were going to eat Christmas Eve night, so I had to leave the next day and go back. And I can't remember what we were talking about. She and I were in the kitchen, and I said, oh, that's just some stupid Archie talking like that. And I said, oh, Lord, I've said it now, haven't I? Got off to a good start with her. But as far as ever hearing the word Okie or Archie, I seldom ever hear it anymore.
Mm-hmm. I have heard some people use it. And in general, it means, as you said, people think of trashy
mm-hmm.
people or ignorant,
yeah.
dirty,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. Do you think people just don't understand that there are two meanings to the word? That it means, on the one hand, just someone from there?
People don't want to understand that there's two different meanings of it. Some people don't. They just want to call Okies, trashy Okies. That's all they want to, it's the way some people look at them. Well, even if I wasn't from Oklahoma, I wouldn't say things like that about people. I say, well, there's one family I met from Oklahoma. Now, they were Okies. They had 8 kids. And honest to goodness, that woman and those kids never took a bath. We lived on a ranch and they moved on it. They never took a bath. They never combed their hair. It was, we used to call them a typical Okie. All the people that lived on this ranch where we lived on down south of Bakersfield. And we called them typical Okies because they were the typical people that came from Oklahoma that had the trashy name as Okies. And the kids are all grown and married now. They still live the way their mother raised them. And their mother's dead, but they still live that same way. And you know there's no reason for anybody to live that way nowadays. Because a bar of soap don't cost much, and they could go to the river and take a bath. No other way.
And did that bother you very much at the time that trashy people like that were using Okies in general?
At that time it did, because my kids, with that family, because my kids were the same age of some of her kids, and they went to school together, and they played together, and so I would...
try to keep my kids, you know, clean. In fact, when the girls, one of the girls, my daughter, oldest daughter, was with all the time, she'd come to my house and I'd make her take a bath. And so it was.
Do you remember if your children ever had any problems, say at school or
no.
with other kids?
No.
Calling them all to you?
They never. I know a lot of people say, oh, they were mistreated and all this when they came out here in the 30s. I can't really say that I was. Because I don't recall anybody trying to mistreat us for any reason whatsoever. Because all we were doing was just trying to make a living. And they would... like I said, when they had that strike down there, or was trying to have the strike down there the first fall in 1937, in the cotton fields, well, we'd just go and sit down in the middle of the field till they'd leave, and then we'd go back to work.
Do you think you can account for that discrepancy? Do you think that maybe, say, people who wrote articles in newspapers and magazines, and Steinbeck when he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, and perhaps historians now that have written a little bit about the Dust Bowl have exaggerated the problems that people have?
Maybe not the problems. Well, yes, the problems too. One of them, the way we lived. Now, they down the labor camp there was, you know, tents built up. Platforms built up with tents over them. Well, you know, you could keep them clean, and there was nothing wrong with living that way, because it was the only way you could live. And of course, now they've built the labor camps up to where they're better than what they were. They have better homes to live in and everything, but there was people down there that didn't care, and then there was other people that made a home out of those tents that they lived in. The other people just made a stopping off place to lay down and sleep. And they didn't care whether they had a bed or anything at all.
I was thinking particularly of John Steinbeck. Have you read The Grapes of Wrath?
Yes.
Seen the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in my opinion, the story that Steinbeck told was read by an awful lot of people who took that to be a stereotype. They thought that all the
That's
people
right.
who came out here well, had to live like that.
The Grapes of Wrath.
Mm-hmm. Had the same experiences as these people did, or the same kind of experiences.
Yeah.
And that would be very true to me.
Yeah, they, well, you know, people would say, oh, well, they're, how would they say it, come out of the grapes of wrath. That's what they'd say, a lot of things. Well, I think Steinbeck exaggerated in that book. That's why I said that somebody should write another one, a sequel to that. Because I really think he exaggerated a lot, because when those people were in those trash dump places trying to find, I remember one scene with Henry Fonda when he was trying to find a can, you know, to get have something to eat out of in the pile of trash. I don't think anybody done that. Especially people that like the Jode family that was trying. They were trying, that's for sure. And I think he just downgraded them. And
he painted them as very, very crude people.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
His only real concern was existing, continuing to eat and sleep and live.
Yeah.
And they really didn't ever look beyond that. And he
That's right.
painted them as so crude and ignorant.
And I think he exaggerated on that. Now, I think Henry Fonda done a good job in that movie, but I don't know anything about making movies, but I don't think they could have got me if I'd have been Henry Fonda to have made that movie. I mean, if he had had any
respect at all, if he had known anything about the people in the San Joaquin Valley from Oklahoma. It's just like oh, what was the guy's name that narrated this? What was his name? Anyway, when he came up here to do this, I didn't see him, but they said, those people from England said that he was so mad when he came up here that day it was hot, and his chauffeur lost the way coming out there, went on past the labor camp, on into weed patch, and had to turn and come back. And they found the place, and they got out, and it was, oh, it was hot that day. I was there after he left. And Glenn Ford, that's who it was. They said he got out of that car, and he was throwing his screaming fits that wouldn't quit because he had to come up here and do that. And Mr. Burmeister told me, he said, when he got to the gate of that Arvin labor camp, Sunset Labor Camp, that his personality changed just like that. He walked through there, he done that, and you would have stood there and you would have swore that the man was born and raised in that camp, the way he was talking. And said he'd come back out, they turned the cameras off of him, and he started cussing again and got in his car and left. And
can we go back to the Great Giraffe for just a minute now? Can you remember some other ways in which Steinbeck stretched the truth? We said that he painted them as very ignorant and crude people, and that he had them digging through garbage cans and things like that. Can you remember any other ways that
so
he
long.
Misrepresented them? I remember the language being very, very bad.
And I don't think that...
And some of the things they did that were not...
Because back in the 30s, people didn't use language then like they do now. They just they didn't say anything at all. My husband seldom ever said a word, and if I ever said over a word more than darn, when I was a child growing up, if I even said that, my parents got me. And Steinbeck was writing this, and I don't think that. I think he exaggerated there about the language. That's what I'm trying to say. And I think he exaggerated about their trip out here. Someone of them died on the road out here, and they stopped and buried them beside the road. I don't think there's any state in the United States that would let anybody do that and get by with it. Not even back then in the 30s. I don't know. I could be wrong, but I don't believe they would. So there was a lot of things in there that I think he exaggerated about.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that most people, when they think Oki, they immediately think of Steinbeck, and that's the impression they have?
I think they do, and the people from Oklahoma, they do not have any use for Steinbeck. People live back there over that Grapes of Wrath. The biggest majority of the people in Oklahoma, they didn't even want the show in Oklahoma. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't either after I went and seen it. But I didn't see it for years after it came out. I didn't go see it. It was, I guess, 10 years after that I seen it. Then I saw it on television. I read the book a couple of times, but it's been years since I've even read the book or seen it on TV. But there was a lot of things I think he exaggerated about. That's the reason why I keep saying that somebody should write another one, and if I knew how to write one, I'd write it. But
do you think that the book and the movie, The Grapes of Wrath, had very much to do with the views people have had of Okies? Do you think it really had a great deal to do with bad views?
Yeah, I think so. And but this Eugene Burmeister told me This was done in 78. He told me that when he retired that he would write another one. But of course, it's going to take him years to write a book, a sequel to that, because he's going to have to, in my opinion, he's going to have to talk to a lot of people to learn what went on. Now, this deal with this these people from England, I'm sure he's got every bit of that.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that? It was called When Havoc Struck?
Yeah, mm-hmm. When Havoc Struck.
And was that part of the series that the BBC was doing?
Yeah, the BBC was doing it. It was, When Havoc Struck. And they was, I forget how many series that they had. They'd done the Florida Hurricane and the Hindenburg Disaster. And so
the Central Valley here.
Mm-hmm. See, they filmed some of it in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. And so they were considering the dust storms as the havoc.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That caused the people to come here in California.
Yeah, that's what they were doing.
And was the whole program about that? That one episode all about?
The one that I was in?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yes, that one episode was all, it was a 30-minute show. And it was people in Oklahoma and people out here. In fact, I'm not sure, but I think I was the only one that was in California that was around in Kern County that was in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, I could have been mistaken.
Were you interviewed?
Yes.
Or you told about your experiences there?
Yeah. And I'm sure maybe that Mr. Burmeister has all the information on this. All of it. He would probably have. Could give you a lot more information that the BBC researched.
Mm-hmm.
I would think he'd have it.
Do you think they gave an accurate representation of what happened?
Mm-hmm.
When you get it on TV later on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they did, because they talked to people in Oklahoma and people that had never left Oklahoma that stayed through the dust storm. And I think it was older people, you know, that lived through it. So it was accurate, I think, to the best that people could remember how it happened. And so, but now Mr. Burmeister's not from Oklahoma; he's from Indiana, I think. But he was working with them. It was 12 week series. But now, it was 12 different, When Havoc Struck was the name of it. It was 12 different series. It was 12 weeks, it says here.
Okay. Now, these were all British people
in
the crew,
uh-huh.
And who wrote the script, except for Glenn Ford, who was the narrator.
Yeah, and it was so funny. Maybe we talk funny to them. But we were talking about Glenn Ford. We was at Sunset School there before we went down to film this, and we were talking about it, and this one guy, he says, he was the most obnoxious man I ever met. And I said, well, I wish I had known he was going to be here this morning. I would have been over here, too. And he looked at me and he said, you can bloody well have him. He said, we don't want him anymore. So he really must have been obnoxious to him. And
do you think that possibly one of the reasons that this series, this When Havoc Struck, was better than, say, The Grapes of Wrath or other articles?
Because it told the truth.
Well, do you think perhaps one of the reasons was because this was produced by British people who could be much more objective? They were looking from the outside into what happened in America, whereas Steinbeck and other people have written about the Dust Bowl era have all been Americans, and they all have some point of view.
Well, it could be, because, like you say, they were outsiders, and they were getting the information and the people in Oklahoma that had never been, that stayed, lived through the dust storm in those 30s back there. They know what went on, and they told it the way it was, because they were country people, and they had lived their life on those farms back there in Oklahoma, and they were just telling it like it was. And so I think that that told it more than anything else, more than what Steinbeck done in that long book of his.
Kind of related to that, when Steinbeck exaggerated a lot of Okie characteristics, I wondered if you think there are certain things about Okies, perhaps their language, or at the time the way they dressed, or the food they ate, that made people recognize them as Okies.
Maybe the food they ate, because that's one thing. When you come, when we came out here, and well, still, the people from Oklahoma eats different than what they do in California, because people in Oklahoma raises their own food, most of it, in their gardens. And so when it comes to eating beans and fried potatoes and cornbread, it's just different from what they do out here. And I have now, every once in a while, I have somebody come in. Oh, my nephews that was raised, born and raised out here, he'll come in every once in a while. Oh, why don't you cook some beans and cornbread? So I set them all down. I'll cook a big lot of it and get them all in to eat, and then they'll go on. Now me, I don't like it. I don't like beans, and I don't like cornbread. But that's the way most people were raised.
When they came out here to California, did most of the Okies continue to eat the way they did in
Oklahoma? Yeah, because one thing, the potatoes were raised down there at Arvin, and they didn't have to buy them. they could just take them home out in the fields, and they continued to eat the way they did in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So that's one difference that... Well, that wasn't exaggerated. They do, but they didn't do like he showed them. Even the people on the way out here, the people that loaded up their trucks and brought their families and come to California, where it would take them no telling how long to get here. Well, they had their things with them to cook and eat by the side of the road. And they didn't have to get out and dig in the trash for those things to have, because they had their plates and everything right along with them. So there's where Steinbeck exaggerated there, I think, because I don't think there was anybody that had to do that on their way out here, you know, and after they got here. What I'm saying is the people that come in their trucks, like it showed the Jode family coming. Now us, we came in a car, but when we got a place to live, we went to secondhand stores and we bought enough for us to get by with. So I think he exaggerated terrible there.
When you first came out here and money was a little tight as you were traveling from job to job, were there some kinds of food that you found that you couldn't have because you couldn't afford, or foods that weren't available to you?
Well, there was foods that we couldn't have because we just didn't have the money that we eat the basic foods. We could have bought... say we didn't eat meat every day, but we bought the other things And you take the biggest majority of the people that came out here in the 30s, and if you'll just check around on them now, talking about eating. Okay, we didn't, like I say, we didn't eat meat every day. But we eat a lot of fruit, and none of us have any problems, you know, that even look like we ever suffered from malnutrition. I mean, the biggest majority of the people. And we didn't take vitamins, but we had, like I say, the fruit, the fresh fruits, which I think we eat more fresh fruit then than people do now, because it was there for us to pick it off the tree and eat. We had any amount of it we wanted. And the potatoes, we got them, which that's just a starchy food, and people shouldn't eat too many of them. But, and we had, a lot of vegetables that were grown around, you know. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have any problems. We didn't with food, because if we didn't have money, we always had them put away, had food put away like that would keep. And we had the fresh fruit practically anytime we wanted it. And that's one thing I never buy now. I buy the canned fruit, but I don't buy fresh fruit. So, which I think is a lot better for you than the canned fruit. But people raise their kids up with eating fresh fruit and any, you know, food like that, the basic foods. And I really don't think they have as many problems then as they do now, trying to poke these vitamins down these kids because they don't want nothing but a candy bar or something like that. And
how about the Okie accent? A lot of people who came from that area, Texas, Missouri.
Well, do you think
Oklahoma.
I still have it? On those tapes? Yeah.
And a lot of people recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That as they'll say, oh, you're from Oklahoma, or oh,
yeah,
you're from that area.
To me, I can't see that I talk that way, but I can hear on tape. Here a while back, I was on tape and I heard, gee, do I still talk like that? See, I can go back to Oklahoma now, to my sister's house, and get on the phone and call somebody, and they will think it's her. And she's lived there all of her life. My youngest daughter, when she was small, I'd take her back to Oklahoma, stay 2 weeks, and Lord, it took me 6 months to straighten that girl out with her talking. And but I think they
I talked to some people that had a few problems with it, because people would hear their accent and look down on them or criticize them for it. Did you ever have any problems with that?
Mm-mm. No. But now I've got some of my relatives in Oklahoma. I can't believe that I ever talked that southern accent like they do, or that whatever it is. I sit and laugh at them when I go back there. And but my sister and I talk just alike. She don't talk like her daughter does. So I don't know.
When you were first out here in the 30s, I know you didn't have any children in school then, but when you went other public places, say to stores to buy things, or to church, or to a movie house, or a restaurant, or something like that, did you ever encounter any difficulties?
No, because all the people were from Oklahoma, too.
Most of the people came in contact with,
mm-hmm,
were also from Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, Texas, or Arkansas, yeah. And they, I suppose they all talk the same way. I never was one to put on the emphasis of the way a person talked or anything, because, I don't know, I just...
I've talked to a couple ladies that had, say, gone into a store or whatever, and maybe because of their accent or possibly the way they're dressed, something about them told the clerk or the store manager that they were okay, and they weren't treated as
that
well
was back in the 30s?
People. Yeah, back in the 30s.
Well, I was never treated that way. I can't recall ever a time anybody doing me that way.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you fit in the community pretty well then? You felt comfortable wherever you went?
I did, yeah. I guess because I've always, wherever I go, I can talk to people. I'm one of them that puts that foot in my mouth every time I open it, but nobody pays any attention to me when I do it. But it's most people, I think, if you say you talked to those two women, I think they were going around looking for it.
That's true.
That's what I think. They were going around with a chip on their shoulder. I'm from Oklahoma, so what? And that don't get you anywhere. Because at that time, we were all from Oklahoma. We were all Okies. And that didn't make a bit of difference. I could see. But just like I said, this friend of mine, she wouldn't tell people she was from Oklahoma. And One time I went to see her, and she was living in a tent, and it was pouring down rain, and she didn't even have a platform on that tent, and water rolling through that tent. And I said, boy, if some of your friends would see you now, they'd know you're an Okie.
And there are a few things I wanted to backtrack on. One of them was when you were talking about welfare. You said that you had to take it one winter until the spring came and you could go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you referred to some other Okies that took welfare every year, all the time. Do you think there were very many people that relied on that?
There was, I think so. Some of them that had families had to, but there was people just like they do the welfare nowadays. They do it because they don't want to work. But we had welfare in the last spring of 1938 for 1 month. And then we had welfare again in 1949 because my husband was bad sick. He had spinal meningitis. And we had welfare for 1 month then. And that's all we ever had welfare.
A lot of the people that I've talked to will say that they occasionally, because of bad times, had to take some help. Mm-hmm. But most of the time they would do anything they could not to take help.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that most of the people were really pretty proud, and they didn't want to have to do that.
No, they didn't want to have to do it. And but I can see that people back then with families, with children, that they had to take it because they could get out. Maybe the man could get out and work one day today, and he might get more work for a week or so. Well, one day's work wouldn't feed a family very long. We always tried to, I did what I would do when we were both working. Well, then I'd buy, and store food away, canned stuff, and but some people didn't even try to do that. Of course, I know a lot of people that still does that nowadays. I mean, it's the only way to live now. But my daughter does. But I always stored food away so we would have it when there wasn't any work, and that way we didn't have to go on welfare.
Mm-hmm. You told me you had, what, three children?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you'd tell me a little bit more about them and what they're doing now.
Well, my oldest daughter is living in Shafter, and she's a housewife. She works part-time. She has three children. A 21-year-old son, 18-year-old daughter, and a 5-year-old baby. And her husband, we worked with his family on the Hoover Ranch in 1938, before he was born. And well, his mother, his parents didn't come, but his grandparents and some of them. And he works for Bakersfield Ag Chem. He has a good job. My son was born in 1946, and he has three children. And he was born with an ulcer. So we had problems with him until he was about 12 years old. And he's a deputy sheriff in Tulare County, and doing real good, and we're real proud of him. And my youngest daughter was born in 1951 in Bakersfield. They were all born in Kern County. And she's got one little boy, and she's working at Memorial Hospital. She's divorced. And my husband passed away in 1972. He worked on the farms all the time up until about 1952, and he went in a shop as a welder. And he got sick in 1970, and he had cancer, and he passed away in 72. And of course, everybody knows when you have cancer, especially for 2 years, how much it can cost you. So when he passed away, well, I was completely bankrupt, because his doctor and hospital bills was over $50,000. And all I had was $4,000 insurance when he passed away. So I've made it real good. I draw his Social Security now, and I'm not rich by any means, but yeah, I get by.
But looking back on things over the years, are you glad that you did come out here and stay?
Yes. I just thank the Lord every day for leaving Oklahoma and coming out here, even back in the 30s. Because I think the people that came out here in the 30s well, of course, the Depression was all over as far as that goes, but we came to California, like I say, for new horizons, and it wasn't here, and we struggled, and we made it. And
do you think your children have been better off here than they might have been back in Oklahoma?
I'm sure they would have, because my husband was like me. He didn't get much of an education. He finished eighth grade, same as I did, so he knew nothing but farm work, and the farm work just was nothing in Oklahoma to go out and get a job on the farm, because the farms were small and everybody farmed, done their own work. The farmer owned the land, and he tilled the land himself. A few of them hired help, but not much, and they didn't pay anything. So no, I would not go back to Oklahoma. I am proud that I came to California. And I am proud to call California my home. And because to me it is home. I came out here when I was 19 years old, and I'm 62 years old now, so my life has been in California. But I wouldn't take for my growing up in Oklahoma. And I get homesick to go home to see my family. Occasionally. Now I try to go back every year, but it's getting harder every year to go back because it takes more.
So you still have ties there with your other brothers and sisters?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And My sister's coming out the 15th of March, one of them. Like I say, I'm having surgery the 1st of March, and then she's coming the 15th to stay along with me. And I'm really going to enjoy that. So, I've never regretted coming to California, even when I was here for 4 long years and didn't see anybody but one brother. And I still wouldn't have went back to live if my family had known what I was going through out here, which I'm sure my father did, because he talked to other people that come out here and went back. There was one man that I met when I first came into the Arvin labor camp. He was standing there, and he knew me because he knew my father. And anybody that from Garvin County sees any of my family, and they know us. And he said, the first words he said, "I never thought I would see one of the Beddoes in California." And I looked at him. "You know me?" He said, "Sure, I know your daddy well." Well, he went back, and I'm sure he told my father how the living conditions and everything were out here, but my father never said a word to me about it. And as long as I would write to him at least once a month, well, that's, he never said a word about how he was getting along, but he knew that I knew if I needed help, all I had to do is write and tell him. But we made it on our own.